This is gonna be on soon.
Fast, yeah.
We're not gonna take it. Let this meeting of Hess come to order. It is, whoops, a little cheat here. Members present, the meeting is called to order at, on January 23rd, 1996, at 3 p.m. Representative Cynthia Tui presiding, present members are Representative Roteberg and Representative Bundy. A quorum is not present. On today's calendar, we have House Bill 339, terminate parental rights of prisoners, Representative Roteberg's bill. House Bill 30, dress code for public schools, Representative Davies, who is not here, but will be, her legislative aide will be speaking to the bill. And House Bill 60, impairment rating guides for workmen's compensation. Again, another bill for Betty Davis, and that will also be taken up by her legislative staff. You are. Thank you, Representative Davies. This meeting is being teleconferenced. If anybody's out here that would like to testify, if you'll please sign up at the on the table outside, we'd appreciate it.
Representative Bryce.
Please let the record show that Representative Bryce has arrived.
And
Representative Gary Davis.
We now have a quorum.
Thank you. We now have
You're
a quorum.
Welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you again. Thank you. We now have a quorum. We'll now take up House Bill 30. If John Sperling, if you would like, Sperber. Excuse me for mispronouncing your name. If you would like to step forward, and also Representative Davis is on the teleconference. Excuse me, John, are you going to be testifying, or did you want Representative Davis to testify?
Of course, Representative Davis, if that's what she wishes. and
yes, open
the yeah. Yes, go ahead. Can you turn that up? That'll be fine. Thank you. Okay, John, go ahead, please.
Okay. What I wanted to do is just to read...
for the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Jonathan Sperber. I work as a legislative staffer for Representative Betty Davis in room 430. What I wanted to do at Representative Davis's request was read just a very few brief introductory statements from her sponsor statement and other materials regarding House Bill 30, which provide for a dress code for public school students. It's noted that the adoption of an optional school-wide uniform policy is a reasonable and economical way to provide protection for students without taking teachers away from their normal duties, and that this legislation would also put parents in position to choose the type of clothing they think is most suitable for their child and their child's school environment. This legislation grows out from the belief that we live in an increasingly more violent society, and that any steps that a school district can take to protect its students deserves our careful consideration. It's emphasized here that the dress code will be completely optional under this bill, that no student would be forced to comply with it. The dress code policy would not be implemented with less than 6 months' notice, allowing students time to purchase uniforms. Representative Davis has stated in correspondence with constituents that as a legislator, she has had the opportunity to travel widely throughout the United States. She is appalled at the violence that is spreading out from our blighted urban centers and believes that any steps a school district can take to protect its students should be seriously considered. Included in your packet are certain documents, including an article from an issue of last month's Sacramento newspaper, which Janet Reno spoke very positively of the Long Beach School District having recently adopted a uniform policy, and who stated that shortly after the policy was adopted, that fighting dropped by more than half last year from the year before, according to school district figures. Suspension went down 32%, while crime and fighting generally were down 36%. Janet Reno said that she was convinced that uniforms can make a big difference. Also included in the packet are materials from the Long Beach School District, and on the first paragraph, first page of a letter from the Office of the Superintendent, it was stated that in evaluating these programs, the district found that use of school uniforms enhanced school safety, improved the learning environment, reduced ethnic and racial tensions, bridged socioeconomic differences between children, promoted good behavior, improved children's self-respect and self-esteem, and produce cost savings for participating families. Schools with greater compliance levels tended to enjoy commensurately better results. The Long Beach School District also recommended, as I believe Representative Davis does with this legislation, that each school develop incentives and positive reinforcement measures to encourage full compliance with uniform policy should it be adopted by a school district. I just want to say in conclusion that the one person who is scheduled to testify, Lawrence Wiggett, who's governmental liaison for the Anchorage School District, I believe was anticipating that House Bill 30 would be the second bill to be heard this afternoon. So if it turns out that at the conclusion of your taking testimony for this bill, if Mr. Wiggett has not yet arrived, then I would appreciate just reading one paragraph into the record from a position statement of his.
Thank you, John. Please let the record show that Representative Robinson has arrived at the meeting. If you just sit, John, a moment. Representative Bundy?
Yeah, we don't let you off that easy.
Okay.
I'm certainly not in any disagreement with Representative Davis's attempt for uniforms. I think that how people dress has a direct impact on their behavior, and I'll try to avoid any value judgments about the way I think some young people dress nowadays. But they probably have value judgments about adults as well. Having said that, one, I think you mentioned a real key point, voluntary compliance, and I think we not only need to hear from school administrators, we need to hear from school children. I know that this is the first hearing of the bill and it won't be moving today, but that, and for future hearings, I think would encourage Representative Davis to get feedback from, you know, typical victims of this bill. Well, the other thing is that...
Just a moment, Representative. Go ahead.
Other thing I wanted clarification on, and that was you'd mentioned that this would be voluntary, and so I could kind of, and when I think of uniforms, I think the entire school dresses the same. The purpose is to remove the gang tagging and violence and you know, the ego involvement in fashions and all that sort of thing. But yet, did I understand to say that some children may be wearing uniforms and some children may not?
Yes, go ahead, Representative.
So, this is Ben Davis, and I also heard Representative Bundy and the question that he did ask. I'd like to go on record to say that this is not the first hearing of this bill, and we have had testimony coming from children, and it has been also used on several occasions at the time that State Close-Up is coming to Juneau, that they have reviewed this bill, and they had extensive testimony on the bill. This is the second committee on referral, and not the first.
I stand corrected. Thank you.
All right. The other thing that I want to say, when we say voluntary, we're talking about employees of school districts. They are not mandated. What we're not doing is passing up future legislation that will go into effect and say that every school district has to adopt a dress code. It would be left up to the district to decide if they wanted to do it as a blanket school district policy, or if they want to allow each school to decide if they wanted to have a dress code. If the school decided to do it, and we are moving now to site-based management, where decision would be left up to the principal and the students and the parents to decide what would be the code of dress for that particular school, if they may decide to have it. And if they did, then every student that went to that school would have certain colors that they will wear. It's also been my experience in places that I have visited and people that I have talked with that it also helps to develop a great sense of pride in their school. And I have a sister who with the school that just adopted this policy last year, and they praise it high, not just the teachers, but the parents, because they said it has cut down on the amount of money they have to spend on clothes. There's not a lot of competition trying to compete with each other for wearing the best designer clothes, and they do that in elementary schools nowadays. They also say that they wore their uniforms 3 days a week, which is a certain uniform that they have, a certain color, but you can pick the kind of outfits that you want to wear, if you want to wear pants, or if you wanted to wear a skirt, or if you wanted to wear a dress. But they just had certain colors that had to be used. And then one day, they wore their school colors. And the next day, which would always be on Friday, they would allow the students to dress down in whatever they wanted to dress at that particular time. That's just the way one school has done it. But I hope that has been helpful to the community.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Are there any other questions of this witness, or Representative Davis for now? Yes, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Betty, the question I have has to do with some school districts don't require students to attend the school in their attendance area. Have any of the studies shown that if a school adopts a dress code, that do they either gain students or lose students?
I have never seen any information on whether they gain students or lost students according to those that have dress codes, because the ones that I have spoke to just talked about their particular schools and not saying that other people were lost. In my district, people may get zone exemptions for many, many reasons. I don't think that that would be a factor in where a student would be sent to that school or not, but it very well could, because we have certain schools where we have parents that have a need to have their children in a conservative environment. And if they had a dress code, they might have more people to say, go to North Star, or where we have ABC schools. It might be that they don't want their child to go to, they kind of feel they might move, but I don't think it would have a real heavy effect on the school district or the school itself.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Are there further questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Bundy.
Yes, thank you. I'm familiar with the San Diego school system, and I've talked with them about school violence when I had a bill regarding that, and they had a terrible problem, and they solved the problem by getting rid of lockers and backpacks.
Yeah,
And of course, school uniforms. And the question becomes whether Alaska is at that point where we have to address that, or do we want to get ahead of the power curve and solve the problem before it gets here? I guess that's for committee discussion. My question is, do you have a recommendation as to whether this be K through 12 or K to 6 with then more options at the high school level, or this is to Representative Davis?
I'm more interested in, Madam Chair, excuse me, to Representative Bice. What I think is that it will probably be more appropriate for K through 6. However, should a high school want to do that, there's nothing in my bill that would not allow a hard school to do that, but I would hold that there wouldn't be that many schools that would want to do that. As far as getting a jump ahead of some of the violence and things that's going on in our district, you know, several years ago we were trying to discover if we decided we had gangs in our city here in Anchorage, and everyone would say, oh no, we don't have them, but as you can see, we have lots of gangs in the city now, homemade gangs, and a lot of those is coming from other areas. And so what I say is what we do is for the protection of our children, and that we should do everything that we can to make things suitable for the parents and the child. I do not think this is too early of a start for us to do that. We already have at least one site-based school in the Anchorage School District. I don't know what some of the other districts are going, but it's my understanding that Fairbanks and other school districts are moving into that light where there'll be a line more decisions to be made, not by the school superintendents, but also made by the principals and the parents and the students of the individual schools. And so I think it would be more appropriate for K through 6, but it would not preclude a high school district from our schools from taking it also.
Thank you. Any more questions, Representative Bundy?
No, thank you.
One comment from myself as a person that attended school as a child in uniforms all the time. I didn't find them offensive at all because we had no other choice. I think it's a fine idea. Now my question is there anything in the rules and regulations that said this can't be done already?
Probably isn't anything that would keep a school just a school board, because they do have some autonomy and they can set a lot of things up. I don't think there's anything better that we can do as state representatives to say that we are interested in our schools, because we do provide a large percent of the money that goes to our schools. We care about the kind of education that our children get, and I see that as a good role model for us to step that not only just in one school to stop out there on its own, but to say there is something in the statute to say that it's something that's acceptable by us too, to allow them that opportunity.
Thank you, and I'll pose that question to the Department of Education
that
when they're.
That would be great.
Thank you very much. Are there no further comments? Then thank you, Representative Bundy.
Just that as Mr. Wiggett hasn't arrived, you had a statement that from Mr. Wiggett you'd like to read, and then there was a question, I guess.
I'm sorry. What did you just say?
Mr. Wiggett hasn't arrived. He has a statement that he'd like to read regarding Mr. Wiggett's testimony had he been here. And
that's fine. I just spoke with Mr. Wiggett, and they have no problem. The Anchorage School District has absolutely no problem with this at all.
Okay. Well, that's.
And which is basically, I know what you were going to say. I was waiting for you to come, but that's fine. Yes. Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, John. We have signed up to testify Nancy Buell with the Anchorage School District. Department of Education. Nancy? Thank you. You will, for the record, state your name. And
Nancy Buell, B-U-E-L-L. I'm the Director of Teaching and Learning Support in the Department of Education. And I wish to speak to the aspect of the bill about prohibiting certain articles of clothing. The department in general is supportive of the bill, and in fact, I did check with principals' associations to see whether or not anything had bubbled up in terms of concerns. For many years at the University of Alaska Anchorage, I trained principals, and in that time and in my conversations yesterday with the principals' association, I was aware that there were, in fact, dress codes in most of our schools. And yesterday afternoon, when I spoke with the executive director of the Secondary Principals Association, he said that he received the department mandated student rights and responsibilities documents through the initial newsletter from most of the high schools in the state, and that it was his observation that they did include dress code. And those generally speak to prohibited items of dress, and that anything that would just strengthen that, I think, would be welcomed, or something which the administrators of the state would feel like was promoting the safety of children. In fact, a lot of problems do break out over slogans on T-shirts and caps and other kind of jackets sometimes, and things that students sometimes wear that are associated with social persuasions or points of view, or sometimes gangs, unfortunately.
So let me just reiterate, then you're saying there is nothing in law that says we can't do this now?
There is nothing in law that says that you can't do it, no. We probably don't have anything in law that would specifically say you could mandate uniforms, but there also that would be a matter of board policy, and not something that there's anything against either. I agree with the statements that have been made so far, that there is plenty of research that indicates that it does tend to promote a more harmonious climate of less violence, and that study seemed to show that.
Thank you. Representative Bundy?
And the question comes to mind as you discuss the research and prohibited items. I know we've gone through this already, but if you could just address it for the committee, the First Amendment problems, the religious freedom problems. We don't have a great deal of that in Alaska, but there are sects that choose to have their children dress in a certain way, and it's certainly more of a problem on a nationwide level than here.
Okay. Madam Chair, we have in fact had some searches done of legal issues that have arisen over this. They have not arisen over dress primarily. They've arisen over hair length and sideburns and beards is where the majority of the legal problems have emerged. And those and armbands tend to be more associated with freedom of speech than do specific items of dress. And there's been a lot of support, especially in the last decade, from the courts for whatever administrators and teachers can do to try to make the atmosphere of the school more safe, and if that means limiting dress, that's generally been supported. I don't know of any cases where it has not. Religious dress, of course, is highly supported amongst young people, though not necessarily so for teachers. Dress codes for teachers are a whole different issue.
Thank you.
I'm old enough to remember when teachers did.
Thank you.
Have a dress code.
Thank you, Representative.
Now you can't tell them from the
students. Representative Robinson, you were next, and then Representative Bryce.
Well, I'm just curious, is there anything that you believe we need to put into this legislation to allow for site-specific, for example, like here in Juneau, where we do have site-based management, where a school could make that determination? Or would it have to be, again, from the school board to set a policy, and then each school would then determine whether or not they would want to do it?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Davies.
I know there's somebody there from DOE, Davis, but I haven't served on the school board for 9 years. When schools go into what you call site-based management, the management of the schools is then put down to the principal, the council, the board that they set up, and the decisions are made at that level. So therefore, the overall school board, which is the 7 members that we have in Anchorage, would not be the one that would make that mandate. It would be left up to the schools themselves. So that wouldn't have to be anything inside of the bill that's before you to specify that if you were a site-based management school, you could do it on your own, because they would already have that privilege to do so.
Thank you. Representative Bryce, you had a question?
Yes, more or less a comment. My concerns with the bill revolved around First Amendment issues like Representative Bundy was bringing up. But I see where the bill does address those questions, where it does allow the parents to exclude their children from the dress code, and ensures that school districts implement some type of policy whereby a parent could, if for religious reasons, I'm sure, could have their child dressed the way they want. So.
Thank you, Representative. But I unfortunately, maybe I'm seeing something that is not evident to everybody else. I don't see any need for this bill. This is already done at the school district level. Schools may do this now. Is there anything that says that if they decide, a school decides, is this a wasted piece of, Representative Davis, I know you've spent a lot of time with this, but I think that we have the right to do this now.
I agree with you. I know that they have the right that they can do, but my standpoint and the reason that I introduced this legislation is because of my concern and involvement, and I think that we need to be doing everything to set the record straight that even if you have not done it and you can do it, this might be a motivator to get more schools to do it. And I do know that our administrators and that our board members look at the direction that we take at the state level. And if that legislation passed, it might also give some encouragement for one of those schools that might be thinking about it to do it. I don't fear there's a piece of wasted legislation. I know that we have passed things that didn't always agree with everyone, and we can't please everyone. But the one thing that I know that this could do is, even statewide, if they didn't decide to do it, would be fine. If they decided not to do it, they would still wouldn't have to do it. It's not that they're saying you're forced to do it, but it would be an encouragement for those that might want to step out there and do it.
Thank you.
The reason I'd like to see that piece of legislation go forward.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Betty, you just indicated that you feel that a school, a single-site school, would have the authority to impose a dress code, but the first words of the legislation indicate a governing body may adopt.
And that would be a governing body. When you pass
it's
a school
single
board
site.
And
visit
down a site base, then you have a governing body. The governing body is made up out of the principal and the council that they choose, and that would be the parents of the pit sit on the council, which would be similar to a school board. And they make the decisions on how their money will be spent at the schools and the various curriculums that they would bring forth. So that is a governing body.
Okay, thanks.
Sounds
like you've been asked
thank
that
you.
Question before.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Bryce?
I would agree with Representative Davis that the bill is necessary for two reasons. Number one,
excuse me, Representative Bryce, do we have any more testimony? Do you have any questions for?
Well, I guess my question was in response to the statement you made, not the question.
Okay,
you made.
We have some more testifying on teleconference, if we can get that so they're not waiting, and then we can wrap up. Okay, thank you, very much. Mrs. Nikolai Luck, are you still there? Or Ms.?
Yes, I am.
Would you go ahead, please?
All right. I'm a high school student in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I supported this bill, or support this bill, because you keep referring to Long Beach, and while we may not be as problematic as Long Beach or other cities yet, I agree that if a dress code helps avoid or defray the problems here in Alaska and keeps our students safer, it's something that we should be advocating.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions of this testifier?
Yes.
Yes. Representative Davis and then Representative Bryce.
Yeah, this is Representative Gary Davis. I'm sorry I didn't get your name. Ms. Luck, I'll say. As you may have heard, it appears that this is possible at this time. Have you seen any indications in your school district that a dress code has been discussed in the last couple of years?
Supposedly, it's not enforced at all. So, or I've never seen any enforcement of it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bryce.
Ms. Luck, what school do you go to?
Lakeland High School.
What brings you down to testify on this?
In my government class, we are tracking bills.
Neat. All right. Well, good. If there's any information you need about it, feel free to call my office. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. Good. Thank you, Nicole. Appreciate you testifying.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bundy.
And I share your concern that this bill is not necessary to allow dress codes at this time, other than it's probably to eliminate the need for school boards to buy asbestos armor, because I think they would catch a lot of fire and brimstone from various corners if they were to propose the legislation, and I think they're looking to us to give them a little armor plating as what's happening in this bill. I personally would like to hear from more students in my district and parents of the younger students, I think, before I will move forward.
Thank you, Representative. But is there anybody else in the audience who would like to testify? Hearing none, we'll close this to public testimony. Representative Bryce, would you like
Thank
to share
you.
That?
Well, actually, I would. I thought it was pretty funny, especially when I was gaveled down about starting a statement after you had made a statement, and then just recently the statement from my good friend Representative Bundy before public. But that's okay. That's neither here nor there. That's what I was laughing with the good representative on the end about. I appreciate the bill. I think it is necessary because I do believe it does two things. I think it does create the public debate on the issue in the, at the state level to increase the awareness within the public about the possibilities, the goods and the bads of a dress code. I think it also clarifies the statutes one way or another. Whether or not it is allowed. I mean, if the statutes are absolutely clear, are absolutely silent, it's not really clear which way a school district can go one way or another. And by putting such a bill on the books, I believe that we will clarify some of those murky waters on the issue. So while, yes, school districts might be able to go ahead and implement a dress code. It's not very clear how they would fare in court, say, if they were challenged on the legality of it, whether or not school districts had the power. I think this clearly allows them to, or gives them that power, and, starts the public debate.
Thank you, Representative Bryce. Any further comments? I have no intention of moving this bill out today, so we will move on to the next bill on our agenda. The next
Madam
bill,
Chair,
yes, Representative Davis.
I understand you don't have any intention of doing it, but I would like to know your plan for the bill, because the bill has had 1 year and it had another committee of referrals. You're not the only one, and it's my understanding that there is another committee that goes through. When do you propose to have another hearing, and what would you be expecting for me to do, or anyone else to do, for the bill to be heard again?
Well, I would love, what I would like...
What kinds of things do you want to be brought forward? Because based upon the testimony, I do believe that there's been enough input, given that you could go to the next committee of referral, and that there are items that you are going to address that you did not specify at this time.
Thank you. I appreciate that testimony. Thank you very much. We will be moving on to the next... The next item on our agenda is House Bill 339, Termination of Parental Rights of the Prisoners. Representative Roper, would you like to go ahead?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to bring this bill in front of the House Committee. And because of the technical nature of the bill, if you'll with your leave, I will basically read my sponsor statement. To number one, clarify the issue before us. Number two, to make sure that everybody on this committee has at least read the statement. This particular bill is an act relating to the termination of parental rights of incarcerated parents. This bill gives the court the authority to consider incarceration and child custody cases dealing with termination of parental rights. Currently, the courts do not have the statutory authority to do this. House Bill 139 will allow the courts to look at a parent's imprisonment, whether the length of the prison term will include a significant portion of the child's minority, and to consider whether or not the parent has failed to make adequate provisions for the care of the child during the prison term. Now, if a parent is in prison for 10 or 15 years and parental rights have not been terminated, the child can linger in a foster home for years without any sense of permanency and belonging. This bill will let the courts look at the effect on the relationship when a parent is in prison and ultimately give them a tool to make better custody decisions for children. Now, in order to terminate parental rights, the courts have the burden of proof of showing that that the youth is a child in need of aid as a result of parental conduct, and that conduct is likely to continue to exist. Now, Alaska statutes say that the court may order the state to assume custody of a minor who is found to be a child in need of aid as a result of the child having no parent, guardian, custodian, or relative willing to provide care, including physical abandonment. The court said in the AM versus State of Alaska case that the destruction must be brought about by acts of the parent in order to constitute abandonment. The acts of the parent must be willful. Being sent to prison does not by itself qualify as willful abandonment, and this is a key point. Now, the courts have explicitly asked the legislature to amend the statutes to cover situations where parents are in prison. The first time was more than a decade ago, in 1991, in Nadia A. versus the state. Last year, the Alaska State Supreme Court and Mr. Justice Compton again reiterated his request for legislative relief in AM versus the State of Alaska. I'd urge you to look at this bill and give it its consideration. Next, I'd like to direct you in your bill packet to the actual citations. If you look at the two excerpts from Court Opinions for Legal Services, about the third page in, which would be page 29, this is in the AM case. At the very bottom line of the case, it says, in Nadia A., I urge the Alaska legislature to define more clearly the effects of incarceration on parental rights. I do so again. Now, if you go on to the next case, which is, you flip the page over, you see Nadia A., and it's the Pacific Reporter series. You flip in seven pages. I wish I had these tagged for you.
Got a week.
Right. And the next time we'll prepare our own bill packets. This is nicely done except for that. Seven pages in on page 442 of 660 Pacific Reporter. Going down at the very bottom of the second column in the highlighted areas, which are unfortunately rather difficult to read there, I just read that, and this is Justice Compton again saying, I urge the legislature to amend AS 47.10.080C3 so that parental rights may be terminated when a parent destroys the parent-child relationship by willfully committing a crime and failing to make adequate provisions for the care of the child during a period of incarceration. Additionally, I'd like to draw your attention to a letter in the bill packet at the very end by Mrs. Peggy Thompson, who is in the audience today and will be testifying. And in addition, you were provided with a letter from Ms. Kathleen Weeks, Esquire at Anchorage, an attorney at law, deals in a lot of parent child cases. And at this time, I would like to thank my aide, Nia Costello, who did a lot of work on this, and turn it over to me, Madam Chairman, for further testimony on this issue.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Representative Roeperg at the moment? Fine, thank you.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Beasley, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have some questions. Would you rather wait until after we hear more testimony before we have questions?
Right, I probably would refer them to more technical expertise, or people with greater technical expertise than myself to answer, so why don't we proceed with that?
Well, then why don't we move on to Peggy Thomas, if you would come testify, please, if you'd state your name and affiliation for the record, appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Peggy Thomas, and I have been a foster parent for 12 years, and I presently have the children referred to in AM versus State in my custody. They've been in my care for 5 years, and Mark and Samantha first came to my attention in July of 1990 when their father needed to serve 2 weekends in jail, and he requested the State of Alaska take custody of them while he was serving his time because he had no relatives, he had no person to care for them. Their mother was unable to care for them. So they first became my foster children in 1990 for the 2 weekends. And then when the state assumed care again in September of 90, when he was arrested for sexual abuse of a minor and theft in the second degree, and they came into my care full time then. He was subsequently sentenced to 10 years of incarceration with 1 year suspended for a total of 9 to serve. In jail time, that means 5 years, you have good time. And so he'll be out May 14th. Mark and Samantha came to live with me in February 1991 when Samantha was 18 months old and Mark had just turned 4 the day before. And Mark began calling me Mom about that time because obviously he needed someone in his life to fill that role. They have contact with their birth mother. often. She lives now in out of state. We contact her by phone. We have a court order by their father to contact him weekly. We do that because he's in Palmer at the moment, serving his time there. And so every morning we have a Saturday morning phone call with children speaking with their father, and he speaks with them. But I want to tell you that Mark and Samantha have grown up in my home.
It's okay.
You'd like to take a break a minute?
That's right. And Samantha being so young, I'm the only mother she knows. She knows she has another mother, Mom Sharon, and she knows her father. The mother has relinquished her parental rights.
Nice.
Thank you. Saying it's okay if I would adopt them. It's fine with her. The father, on the other hand, wants his children back when he gets out of jail. Their father had entered into the sex offender treatment program in Highland Mountain, but dropped out because it was too difficult for him. And so he's an untreated sex offender. And I guess I wish that this bill had been, at the time, that the judge could make a decision and say that he's incarcerated, it's likely to continue, the behavior hasn't changed, it most likely will not change. He has a history, a juvenile history, he has a history now, it seems likely to continue. The children have become part of my family. We've now, about 2 years ago, I let them call my brother and my sister aunt and uncle. After 3 years, I thought, well, it's about time they could call them aunt and uncle. Mark feels loyalty toward his father. He doesn't know where he fits into this pattern because he speaks with him, but is he going to live with him after he gets out? Is he going to live with me? What's going to happen to him? He's the one who feels it the most because he's had previous, you know, being with mom and dad and being shifted around. And Samantha, on the other hand, is more stable because she's grown up in my home. And it's 5 years of her life. That's a majority of her life. And children change and grow so quickly. Anyway, we are a family. And 5 years out of Samantha's life is the majority of her life. And we still don't have a decision from Judge Carpinetti as to the termination of dad's parental rights yet. And so I don't know if they're going to be living with me. And Mark doesn't know whether he's going to be living with me or he'll be sent back to his dad. I don't think that DFOS will allow that to happen, but he doesn't know. And he really wants permanency. This year in third grade, he started signing his initials MT. And the teacher couldn't understand. He thought it was MM. And I guess that it was because he's using my last name and he's trying to somehow become permanent. Samantha thinks her name is Samantha Nicole Thomas. Although I've not suggested that to her, she's put that together on her own. And they just need to belong to someone. And I just wish that the judge would have this option of terminating if it doesn't look like it's going to be, that they'll get it together.
Thank you, Peggy.
You're welcome.
We just sit there for 1 minute and let's see if we have other questions. Representative Robinson.
Yeah, Peggy, just, I'm kind of curious. I mean, probably what's going to even put the child in even more limbo is more than likely, because of the sexual abuse, that the division will come in and intervene.
Right.
And so even though dad's out of jail, they'll still be in limbo.
It'll continue on because they're not going to give him back right away.
I understand we do have somebody from the Attorney General's office here who will we asked some straight questions. So are there other questions of this witness? Representative Roteberg?
Oh, thank you, Richard. I just want to thank Ms. Thomas for coming. Really
sorry.
That was very difficult for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Peggy.
You're welcome.
Any other questions further? Not hearing none. We will have the next testifier, Jan Ruthdale.
Rutherdale.
Thank you. Come on, Jan, if you'll state your name and affiliation for the
Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jan Rutherdale, and I'm Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Law. And my duties are to represent social workers in child in need of aid cases, and sometimes we have termination cases. I was the attorney that represented this case, the AM case that went up to the Supreme Court in 1995. And I think this case is really an excellent example, hopefully the worst example, of how complicated a case can get when you have to work with this legal fiction that because the person is in jail, and that's an involuntary act, obviously they didn't voluntarily go to jail, we have to sort of pretend that they're not in jail and look at conduct other than the conduct maybe leading up to what got them into jail or the conduct that they just had in caring for their kids before they got to jail. Because the court constantly focuses on what is the what is a person's parental conduct, which is a good thing to focus on, because you know, there may be people, there may be instances where, well, you always should look at how a person's conduct can affect their ability to raise their child. It would seem to me in this case, and I argued it again when this case went up to the Supreme Court, that the conduct in committing the act itself, which led to the incarceration, which obviously was, I mean, voluntary, I mean, you have to, it, to be convicted, it has to be a voluntary act, was in itself a conscious disregard of a parental obligation. Because if there's a likelihood, if you're committing a very serious act, sexual abuse of a minor, for example, it will result in a, and you get caught, it will result in incarceration for a lengthy period of time, and that means an absent father or mother or whatever in that child's life. In any case, this case, because we couldn't argue, just look, this man has 5 years or more to spend in jail, that's a very significant portion of this, these very young children's lives, an important period of their lives, you know, we couldn't look at that. And so just to give you a sense of how complicated this case has become, it went to termination. The trial was in the fall of 1992. The court didn't rule on it until August of 1993, maybe an indictment on the slow process of the court. But it went up to the Court of Appeals, or the Supreme Court, in 1990. It was argued in March of 1994. Even though the law, the rules say that it's in children's cases, you have to, it's expedited, it's expedited appeal, they took until February of 95, almost a year later, to issue a decision. It was remanded. We didn't lose. They just said the court needs to relook at it and look at another way. The remand hearing was in May of 95, and the court still has not ruled. There is a hearing this Friday to deal with a very minor issue, and once we deal with that issue, the case can go various ways from there. There's no question that the if whichever way the court rules, it will be appealed again. If we lose, we'll appeal it. If he loses, he'll appeal it. Who knows how long it will take after that. Meanwhile, these children are getting older, and they need some permanency into their life. So this bill is a very important step toward that goal of freeing children for adoption. I think that there are two concerns. One is maybe almost too minor to even mention, but I wanted to point out that in subsection 1 on line 9, it says parent is incarcerated as a result of a voluntary act committed by the parent. And as I said before, it's you can never be incarcerated for a crime without it being a voluntary act. You can be in jail, like on a 24-hour intoxication hold, but of course that wouldn't result in someone seeking to terminate parental rights on that basis. I know why this was put in there, voluntary act, because the court says you have to, you know, going to jail is involuntary act, and we have to look at voluntary conduct. I guess it's a concern that perhaps it can muddy people in jail. For a significant, having been convicted of a criminal act, by nature it has to be a voluntary act. It just may not make a difference one way or the other. But I thought I would just point that out. The second point is subsection 2, the period of incarceration imposed includes a significant portion of the child's minority. Again, I understand, in fact, I may have last year maybe even have helped propose that exact wording. And the thought of that, behind that, is to a 15-year-old, if your dad goes to jail for, say, 2 years, big deal. I mean, you know who your dad is, and you probably can you know, you form those attachments, and it would probably do more harm to have your parental rights terminated, your father's parental rights terminated, than to just wait those 2 years out in state custody if need be. But if a child is, like Samantha's age, 18 months when she first went into state custody, 2 years, 5 years is a lifetime for a child, and it's just so important that they have that permanency. So the thought is, it's sort of a sliding scale. As they're younger, a less period of time is more significant. As they're older, a greater period of time could be tolerated. Shortly, within the last week or so, someone in my office pointed out that deals with legislation much more than I do, pointed out that it's possible a court could sort of read that a different way and sort of saying, well, if the child is 2 years old and so she has 16 years before she reaches majority, really a four-year period of incarceration is a very small part of that 16 years. And so it could almost be read the other way, that the older you are, the more significant it becomes because it's a greater proportion of the amount of time left in your minority. One possibility...
Excuse me, Peggy, I have a question.
Jan,
I'm sorry, Pam. Is there any chance you think that a judge in his right mind would return a child to a convicted sex offender?
Yes.
As a single parent, as an untreated sex offender,
probably
he's not
going
to be able to live on my block, much less get a child back.
Right. I agree with you. I don't think any judge would do that. But it doesn't solve the problem of that whole problem of foster care.
Sure. I agree, and I think that there's a definite need for this. Thank you. Continue if you want, if you'll wrap up for that.
So maybe one possibility is to have some sort of brighter line, for example, having a presumption of...
Peggy, may I make a suggestion?
Sure.
This bill is going to judiciary.
Okay.
So may I suggest that you leave that till we get to judiciary?
Sure, I'll do that, and I'll certainly work with it. I think it needs, a lot of it is a policy call. You know, how many years is that bright line? And I just can't answer that because it's not
fine.
A legal question.
That's fine. Are there any questions of Pam? I'm sorry to call you Peggy.
Jan,
Pam, Sam.
It's
okay. Let's do that.
Pam and
Representative Bundy?
Thank you. And one of the questions I had, I think, have been dealt with, and that is how many years before you terminate. And I will leave that to judiciary because I'll get to hear you there.
Right.
But how many cases in Alaska would fall under the purviews of this statute?
Well,
and in recent history?
You know, in terms of termination of parental rights, it's a very drastic measure, which isn't done all that often. I mean, of course, Juneau, you know, I don't have figures. Anchorage, of course, is a much larger population, so I'm sure it's much more common there. I know in talking to my colleagues up in Anchorage, they were saying, yes, change the bill because we have run into that problem before. I you know, it could be maybe five times in the last 10 years. It could be 10 times, you know, but I think it would be in that range.
Thank you. Are there any other? Yes, Representative Easy.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Jan, I'd have to agree. I thought your testimony conflicted with subparagraph 2 there. I certainly don't read it the way you testified.
Yeah, so that's a problem.
In fact, I'd read it just the opposite, that if a person was 15, only had 3 more years of majority, that 2 years would be a significant portion of that child's minority. I'm a little uncertain about a lot of criminal law, but what kind of incarceration is there that would not be as a result of a voluntary act?
Yeah, that's the point. There is none. You can be in jail if, say, you're found drunk on the street and there's no room at the alcohol placement and they have to put you in jail, or you're unruly and they need to put you in jail to protect yourself. From others, but that would be for 24 hours at most. So really, there is no...
Perhaps getting caught was not the voluntary act.
Thank you. Representative,
I'm sorry, one more.
Go ahead, please.
In subparagraph 3 seems to conflict with some of the testimony that we're getting.
Well, in this one, I could imagine a situation. Well, the law says that if there is a relative that's willing and able to care for the child, then the child is not a child in need of aid. It recognizes, I could envision a situation where the parent places the child, well, with the child's mother, for example, and obviously we couldn't terminate parental rights in that situation, or if the mother is out of the picture, placing it with the grandmother. And the law as it's set up right now is that's okay. And it, you know, you still run into that problem of this child isn't, well, you don't have the problem of foster care drift. I guess that's the main thing, because if the child's with a private arrangement, then the state is not involved and foster care is not involved, and that foster care, you always have foster care parents who say, I can't deal with this anymore. I've moved on. And so the child has to be transferred every so often. I mean, that's the danger. Whereas if it was a grandmother, for example, who loves and is committed to this child, then it may not be the same problem.
But that doesn't address the problem you talked about, where I think you referred to a sex offender who has not undergone sex offender treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Three would be a loophole around that.
That's true. I mean, it would. But again, if the parent went to reclaim that child from the grandmother, the state could then step in at that point, place the child back with the grandmother. So,
one more question. I'm a little uncertain here. What are we talking about up in on line six and again on I see the word conduct in line six. I thought I saw it somewhere else. Oh, yeah, it's on line six twice.
Mm-hmm.
What is the conduct we're talking about here?
Well,
I assumed it was an act relating to the incarceration.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I read this, it's for purposes. I mean, there's another section already in existence, the C3, which says that you have to find that that the child's a child in need of aid as a result of parental conduct, and they're saying for purposes of parental conduct, they can meet that finding if they find these things. So it's sort of a fiction. I mean, you could look at it one way to saying, well, this is, in a way, it's sort of an exception to that general rule that you have to find parental conduct. The legislature is saying the court can find parental conduct if these three provisions are satisfied. Another way to look at it, I suppose, is that parental conduct is the act, the voluntary act in subparagraph one, the voluntary act that results in incarceration is the conduct, and that's what the Supreme Court has said. We are not going to read that into the statute. If that's what you mean by that, you're going to have to spell it out for us.
Well, is what this proposed bill saying then is that we're saying that the parent's criminal conduct is likely to continue if the parental rights are not terminated? I mean, that doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I agree. It's because I think to prove that the conduct in getting the person into jail in the first place is likely to continue, you'd have to show that the person is just not being rehabilitated. But you see what I mean? So if in jail he's not going through his programming, if he's a sex offender, not doing sex offender treatment, the prospects of rehabilitation are really poor, and so his conduct is likely to continue.
Thank you.
We can discuss this further again in the district. Representative Bryce, you had a comment or question?
A quick question. On subparagraph 3, where we say parent has failed to make adequate provisions for the care of the child, when you were going in through your discussion saying that adequate provisions for child care is a family member, a grandmother, an aunt, or something like that, are we implicitly saying that foster care is inadequate?
No, but foster care, I suppose the foster care implies state action, whereas subparagraph 3 implies private action.
How?
Because the parent on his own is making adequate provisions. I mean, maybe I'm reading something into it, but I think calling the Division of Family and Services and saying, please get my child, is not an adequate provision. And maybe it should be spelled out more that the parent has failed to make adequate provisions, which would include guardianship with a person who's suitable to care for the child.
Representative Bryce?
Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
Representative Bundy?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As I understand it, the past program of the state has been to return a child to their natural parents and I'll use my words, at all costs, even if it costs the child. Using the example that Resident Tuzzi used earlier, I would disagree. I think that we have put children back with untreated sex offenders, or the courts have. Mm-hmm. Now, is that the case? Is that a reasonable, fair
statement? I think that...
And maybe I'm exaggerating and going too far, but let me just limit it to say that the past state program has been to return children to their natural parents as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then when it comes to foster care, is there not then a state limitation that says you can only care for them for so long and this is not to be considered an adoption and don't even try to adopt? Is that still a program?
Well, like in the case of Ms. Thomas, she was strictly a foster parent in the beginning, but as time went on, and the decision to terminate parental rights was made, she was looked to as a permanent placement. So it can change. I'm sure, maybe she can speak to that more. They may tell you, now don't get attached to these children. And I think psychologically, I mean, I'm sure she's going through it right now. She loves these kids dearly, but she has to protect her own self for that awful day that may happen that she has to give them up.
I'm asking if the laws have changed, because
sure.
in the past I've my wife and I have been foster parents, and we've been told exactly that. This
right.
is temporary care. Don't get attached. I mean,
right.
That's
yeah,
kind of
exactly.
asinine, but that's what they
yeah,
tell you.
And that's a hard thing to do, and that's hard for the children. But initially, you do try to reunify, hopefully not at all costs, but you do try to reunify the children with their parents. If that's not going to work, then permanency is looked at. If termination is an option, then that's pursued.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bundy. Representative Robinson?
Well, and just, you know, one, I've got a couple of cases I can make sure I get to Roeperg that can be at the next hearings to testify, because it clearly has, you know, happened, and quite often what happens is the fact that the mom may even still have, in your case, for example, if mom was still in the picture, people wouldn't even be looking to intervene in many ways. Dad would get out of jail and all of a sudden they're back together again, or dad is part of that life, and then unfortunately we may have another assault and another victim, and then dad goes back into jail again. So we have a unique circumstance here, because we actually have two protective parents who are trying to protect the child from, and the mother has made that determination. So it's kind of a different, you know, situation here, but without a doubt, and actually I know of another foster care situation where the mother actually made a determination to give up her parental rights. Dad was in jail, actually had sexually assaulted the children, and got out of jail and got custody of those kids again. And so it's definitely out there, and of course turned out to be another nightmare after that.
I correct myself. I can think of a case myself now that it comes back,
right.
where 10 years have elapsed and a psychiatrist determines that, or psychologist, that there is less of a risk, or there's not a risk anymore.
Thank you. Representative Roeperg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Rutherford, thank you very much for your testimony today. For your information and the committee's, I do have an amendment here that corrects section 1. However, I would be very happy in working with you as this bill proceeds, as I hope it will. And certainly we were aware of some of these circumstances. So I do have a question. In Mrs. Thomas's situation, she has an imminent date of, say, May 14th, would this particular legislation and the passage of it, would that be helpful to her and her situation, or is it
no.
too late?
I think it's unfortunately too late for her. Yeah.
Very good. And well, that's too bad. Also, in the letter I have from Kathleen Weeks, an attorney in Anchorage, she states that the many parents desperately want to adopt a child when the child is prevented from being adopted by the potential future parenting of a birth parent in jail for a long term. I mean, so it seems as if there's not only, are you aware of certain circumstances that the potential of an adoption exists, but because of the law we have on statutorily and in the court decision, that's a barrier, an obstacle for that type of activity to take place.
Potentially an adoption?
Right.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
In other words, when we ask the question about, you know, how many people does this affect,
right.
it's difficult to actually get a good statistical number, because
that's a really good point.
People are cut off from even pursuing adoptions when they see this threat of a axe up here legally.
Right, that's true. And I, of course, only deal with public adoptions, freeing a child for adoption. And of course, there's a lot of private adoptions out there too.
Thank you. May I, if there's no Representative Robinson, go ahead.
Yeah, but just on one more issue that I really think we do need to kind of visit and think of, you know, regarding the adequate provision for care. I'm not so sure that you're right or on the fact that that wouldn't, I mean, I'm trying to imagine, okay, I'm a, you know, single father, single mother, have no family, I get arrested, I'm going to jail, and my only option is to go to the state, and so that I have gone to the state and asked them to, you know, please care for my child while I'm in jail. I mean, it seems
that's
to me
that's a responsible act.
That would be adequate care to me. So, I mean, I think that we really need to really think about that section and really clarify it of, you know, what we mean there. And if we believe once they've gone into the state custody, that puts them in another category, then we ought to state that out.
Thank you, Representative Robinson. Further comments from the committee? If not, thank you very much for testifying. I'm going to be returning this bill to the sponsor to come back to this committee if you will work with the young lady from the Attorney General's office, and then we will take it up again very shortly. No, excuse me. Thank you very much. I'm turning the gavel over to my co-chair for the next. I beg your pardon?
We next are hearing House Bill 60, Impairment Rating Guide for Workers' Comp, and this is a bill sponsored by Representative Betty Davis, and we have her staff person here still, and if you would present that bill for us, please.
Again, my name is Jonathan Sperber, and I work as a legislative staffer to Representative Betty Davis. House Bill 60 would provide that the Department of Labor use the most recently published edition of the American Medical Association guides to the evaluation of permanent impairments, including the most current supplementary materials, in making impairment rating determinations. And this legislation is supported by the medical community and by the Department of Labor, and most specifically the Workers' Compensation Office. Department of Labor has stated that, and I'm referring here to a position paper dated April 25, 1994, that's in your committee packet, saying that at the bottom paragraph on the first page of that paper, that allowing the use of the current edition of the publication in effect at the time of the impairment rating will reduce the need for board hearings and ensure that those applicants who meet current requirements will qualify for benefits. The older version of the AMA guides do not include some injury types and do not reflect current thinking on degrees of injury given new medical technology and prognosis for recovery. Your committee packet also includes a letter from... Oh, okay, I just received notice that that unfortunately, that position paper that I just referred to is not in the committee packet, but I'll be sure that it's added to your packets immediately after the meeting. Also in the packet is a letter from Dr. Roy Schwartz, and he said that the AMA's position is clearly stated on page 5 of the guide's fourth edition, which was published in June 93. The position is, quote, "The American Medical Association strongly discourages the use of any but the most recent edition of the guides, because the information in it would not be based on the most recent and up-to-date material," end quote. Dr. Schwartz continues by saying that the position of the AMA quoted above reflects advice that the AMA staff provided in May 1992 to the staff of each state medical society. Additionally, it is the AMA practice to sell or provide only the most recent guides edition. Lastly, I'll just add one sentence from Representative Betty Davis's sponsor statement, noting that there have been significant changes in diagnostic and evaluation procedures over the last 6 years. One of the most important that the Alaska Guide does not address is how the injury affects the patient's daily activity. And I will note that Alaska regulations currently specify that the 1988 AMA guidelines be used, although there has been a subsequent edition published.
Right, thank you. Do we have questions?
Just a minor question. What is the cost? Do you know the cost of these guides? And how often are they published? Every year?
Okay.
And the supplemental, because that seems to be the stumbling block, is the supplemental.
I did check on that at your staff's request. And
I learned that each edition or each new edition costs approximately $75, that the Department of Labor Division of Workers' Compensation requires 3 copies of the latest edition, and that the last 2 editions published were the third in 1988 and the fourth edition in 1993. So I'm not sure how much time elapsed between the first, second, and second to third, but we at least did have a 5-year period between the publication of the third and fourth editions. I can't speak specifically to the cost of supplementary materials in addition to the cost of the main volume itself, but perhaps a representative of the Department of Labor here might have that answer.
And that might be a good juncture to invite further testimony from the Department of Labor. And we also have somebody on teleconference from the Department of Labor. So if I might, I'd go to teleconference first. If you'd stay with us, please, Mr. Sperber, and then we will get some additional testimony. On teleconference, Ms. Toby Steinberg.
This is Toby Steinberger. I'm here on behalf of the Attorney General.
Okay, thank you. A question that comes to mind is regulations require the use of an outdated version of the AMA, but apparently there's a need for a statutory change to use the current one. Should this legislation reflect the ability to update without having to come back for statutory changes?
The Department of Law's position that under the current version of the statute, that when you, before we enforce or use the new edition, we have to get public notice. And currently, there's a proposed reg, which has already been publicly noticed, adopting the fourth edition, 1994. That has been publicly noticed, and in my office, and I'm reviewing it now, and then I would pass it on to Deborah Bear at the Department of Law in Juneau. However, to avoid future regulation changes, every time there is a new edition, this type of statute or proposed bill may prevent from having to have to adopt a new regulation each time.
So if I understand correctly, this you can do what you're asking to do in the statute or what is being asked to be done in the statute. You're just asking for a more efficient process?
Well, the Department of I guess Senator Davis is asking for the more efficient process, but right now we're in the process of adopting the regulation, the 1994 edition.
Okay, thank you. Representative Toohey.
Thank you. A question on the supplemental, because that is addressed in the bill. Is the supplemental updated every year, and are they made available to the public or to the medical community? My concern is if we implement a regulation like this, then what happens if we're not able to get the published edition of 1994 and 1995? Does that tie the hands of the workman's comp and also the supplemental material?
The proposed regulation adopts the 1994 edition. I personally am not really familiar with what is the supplementary material.
Thank you.
I will get to him. Any further questions for Ms. Steinberger? If none, then I'd like to go to testimony here. Did you have a comment that you wanted to make?
I might, Co-Chair Bundy, just to state that it's my understanding in terms of the regulatory process that under the current Department of Law drafting procedures, that a regulation could not be promulgated that would have the similar type of wording that House Bill 60 has, which would state generally that the most current of it available edition of the guidelines be used, but rather the far slower and more cumbersome process would have to be followed, such as this, where it's my understanding that in the neighborhood of 8 or 9 months has now elapsed since a request has been placed with the Department of Labor to draft a regulation requiring use of the now current fourth edition of the guidelines. I think what you're saying is technically correct in that regulation could address what's being addressed by House Bill 60, but that in doing so by regulation be a far slower, far more awkward, and more inefficient process.
Okay, thank you. It's a little scary to think that regulations take longer than statutory changes, but we won't address that right now. Jeff Bullock is here that would like to testify. And if you'd stay with us, Mr. Sperberger, just if you'd have a seat, over here, if you would, please, and we may have additional questions.
My name is Jeff Bullock. I'm representing the Alaska State Medical Association, and they support this legislation. They'd like to see the updated verbiage used in statutes rather than through the regulation process, just to make it a little more clear. And that sheet I handed to Representative Toohey's staff was faxed up by a doctor with the copyright dates of the recent ones that was put out to show that there is anywhere from a few years to many years lapse between the additions.
Okay, thank you. And questions for Mr. Bullock? Before you leave, Mr. Bullock, you had a question, Representative Roper?
I just ask for the verification of the fact that the, as I recall in the Labor and Commerce hearings last spring, that there were representatives of the industry, workman's comp insurance businesses, that were in support of this bill. Would you agree that that would be the correct statement? Or?
Well, I wasn't at the hearing last year, but when it was discussed at the state level with the doctors, they all seemed very supportive of it, to just clarify them for themselves, too.
Thank you.
And no further questions. One further person to testify here in Juneau, Gary Pesca. Ooh, we'll get there. He didn't indicate he wanted to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Pesca, and I'm here representing the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, and our association also supports this legislation. We would like to see the most current guideline be effective rather than having to go through the cumbersome process of changing regulations every time there's a change in those guidelines.
And questions for Mr. Pesca? Seeing none, with our thanks. And I see the Director of Workman's Comp is here. Would you like to testify, or are you just as a resource? I'll assume coming forward means you'd like to testify.
You didn't check off whether you want to testify.
Oh, well, I'm not sure that I, Chairman Bundy and committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grassi, and I am the Director of Workers' Compensation. I don't know that I have a whole lot more to add to this, but the department does support this, and it supports it primarily because we look at it as a way of streamlining the regulatory process. We think this is a way to, get an automatic an adoption of the most current AMA guides. We have to do this as it is under the current law because we're required to use the AMA guides. The problem is, as Toby has probably stated better than I can, that it requires a regulatory change every time that there's a change in the AMA guide. And it is a long and cumbersome process. I don't know if it takes as long as a statutory change, but the fact is once we have a statutory change, then it's in for the duration, and it prevents us, or at least keeps us from having to do this every time. But as stated earlier, we are in the process of changing it to make it the most current regulation or current guide. But we started that process in August. It's now January, and we're close to it being promulgated, but it's still not in effect. I've talked to the AMA guide people, and they're back in August, and they said it would probably be another 2 years before a new guide would be in effect. But that was 9 months ago, so it's probably we're getting under 2 years, of course.
Representative Robinson, and then Representative Deasy.
Yeah, Paul, from talking with my staff, with your staff, and stated that they felt that at the you don't have the bill in front of you, but under line 5B, that it should start with at the time of rating, and I don't, unfortunately, I gave the language to Representative Davis's office, I don't have it, but I believe that's what it was at the time of rating, and wondering whether or not you thought we should insert that.
I think that probably that could, I think that the way it's written right now would work fine. We could pass one more regulation on it and for an effective a date, which would provide some lag time after the publishing of it, so that the medical community, the insurance community, the employers groups, and the employee representatives plus the division could get copies of the newest or most recent edition. There'd probably need to be a little bit of lag time to allow that to occur.
So, with this chair again, so you don't think we need to add that language at the very it's again, it's on line 5B, right in the beginning. It says, at the time of ratings, all determinations. And that was just a language change that I was understood that people thought should be added.
Yes, Representative Davis.
Representative Davis on the line.
Please, go ahead.
My understanding that when the information was passed to my office, that with someone, so Representative Roberts' office said that it came from the Department of Labor.
Right.
So they are there to speak to that in his mind, and that they specified that labels were not needed,
Well, this is an issue that a question that I think perhaps we'd like you to research and then come back to us.
We could do that.
With that answer. Representative Veazey?
Yes, I had a question about the lag time. It looks to me like, I don't know how this will be interpreted, but there would be a lag between the time that the new edition is published and you could get it into your offices and you wouldn't be able to affect any work during that period of time.
I'm not exactly sure how to do this. One of the things that's just coming to mind, I'm really thinking out loud right now, but one of the possibilities is pass a regulation that says that every, quarterly, by way of a bulletin, the division will publish a bulletin indicating the current or the AMA guides that will be in use for that quarter. And they could just, pass one regulation to that effect and it could go into effect that way. But that's just without really looking into it, but that's one possible way of doing it, and it would be a very simple way of doing it. It would require the passing of one regulation, and that a regulation could be used until the law changes.
Representative Veazey?
I think I would differ with you, because you can't pass a regulation that conflicts with statute. Well, you can, but I mean it wouldn't be enforceable if it conflicts with statute. I'm just trying to think, there might be one word in here that might clarify that we do expect a reasonable lag time. I'm not sure how it would be defined as most recently published edition. It may not be considered effective until you can reasonably receive a copy of that edition. That's a reasonable interpretation, but there would be some lag between the time you ordered the material and you got it.
It would be difficult. I would agree. If on the day the publishing of the new guide, there was a rating that was occurring in some doctor's office. They couldn't possibly have be using the most current. So there would have to be a way of putting it in effect. I think it would be relatively simple by just having like a 3-month lag.
Well, one automatic way of handling it would be that you would work with the material you had, and then if material came out that had an effective date that was after your determination, you could make an adjustment. That would take care of it.
May I suggest that this is something also that I'd like you to address before the next hearing on the bill? And try it. So that we don't have a limbo window there, and it won't take another 6 months to write a regulation. Representative Toohey.
On that issue, there isn't a great difference between, you're not looking at a whole new walking leg, are you? I mean, you're not looking at something that all of a sudden technology has developed that's going to totally eliminate this person from workman's comp. I mean, so you're not looking at a major...
No, what you're looking at is the most current science at a given time. And it changes in increments, basically.
Right.
It's not... usually it's not any dramatic change, although there may be some new research that comes out that changes something, but it's usually... incremental changes.
Good. Thank you.
Along those lines, if I might ask, obviously a zero fiscal note, but if we start using the new manual and it addresses how these definitions would affect a person's normal life, I guess I would use that term, using the new definitions is apt to introduce a large number of new clients into workman's comp, or do you have an estimate?
It wouldn't change the number of clients in workers' comp. It would depend on the number of injuries that occurred. If there's a permanent partial impairment that's ratable, then any given injured worker, is entitled to a permanent partial impairment rating, which translates into a sum of money.
I'll just address your attention to the sponsor statement where they talk about The new guide would now address how the injury affects a patient's daily activity. Now, I guess I've heard you say that you don't anticipate that that would increase the number of people on workman's comp significantly.
I don't see how it could. You know, the number of people on workers' comp is dependent on the number of injuries that occur. And
well, but what I'm saying is this may
define
the injury differently, that it wasn't a workman's comp injury prior to this definition, and now it is a workman's comp injury. The need to use Alaska's guide to how an injury affects a patient's daily activity.
The only thing I can, I don't think that it would have an effect. The only possibility would be if there's some new science that came out that would allow for a type of rating system that formerly, you know, they didn't have the knowledge to do that, then that could possibly happen. But, you know,
this is another question that perhaps we can address at the next hearing.
Well, it would require someone from the medical community to answer that.
Okay, well, we know where to direct our questions. Representative Rookberg has a question, then Robinson.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along the same lines, I just want to clarify what the effect of the lag time, which several members have brought up. As I take it, a physician would make a judgment on the rating. So depending on which volume or addition that physician would have, could have an impact on their judgment about whether there was coverage or not coverage. Is that true?
Well, I mean, it would depend. They would have to use a version of the AMA guide. I mean, the rating would have to occur according to this, these guidelines.
Yeah, but if one was out of date just because of the mail, so to speak, that's why the timing is important to be precise here, because that could affect the judgment, and there could be a dispute arising out of whether there was coverage or not based on the rating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why it would have to be established either. I suppose you could do it legislatively, but probably just regulatorily, just have a reg that would give allow for some lag time, you know whether it be 3 months after publication or what have you, and you would have to do it that way just to make sure that the ratings would be done systematically.
To follow up there, wouldn't you prefer a specific statutory date certain, so you wouldn't have to go out and just publish a little regulation? How about no regulation at all? Wouldn't that be best?
It would be the best. What would make us happy is if we didn't have to pass a regulation on this at all.
Yeah. Right, that's really the intent here behind the statute. Okay.
Representative Robinson?
Actually, I just have a statement. I don't have a question. So
if there are no further questions, we'll close public testimony. And would reiterate that it's been the policy of the committee that even though this bill has been heard in other committees, this is our first hearing here, and we have some questions, obviously, we'd like answered. And if you could join us when we have another hearing on this. And so, Representative Robinson, the floor is yours.
Mine's just kind of a friendly statement to all of us that the language has been changed. It is no longer workman's comp, it's workers' comp.
Ah, thank you.
And so just for all of us to kind of keep that in mind as
we
discuss this issue.
Having a hardworking female partner, I understand and agree. A point well taken. All right. Seeing no further testimony or comments on this bill, will be held for an additional hearing. Further business to come before the committee, I'd like to announce that tomorrow at 9 a.m. in the Butkovich Room, we're having a joint Hess hearing with the Senate Hess for a briefing on the comprehensive high-risk insurance pool. This is of concern to the state, and I look forward to your participation and attendance. With that in mind, there will not be a meeting Thursday, January 25th at 3 here.
Okay.
And hearing no further business, we'll adjourn at 4:26. And Mr. Sperber, you heard a number of the questions. The next time we bring this up, if we get some from the medical community to address.